In this episode, we are going to be reviewing Suspicion. This is the 80th anniversary of this film, which was directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It starred Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine, and it was written by Samson Raphaelson, Joan Harrison, and Alma Reville. My guest today is Christina Lane, who is the Edgar Award-winning author of Phantom Lady, which I just finished last night. It's a terrific book on Joan Harrison, the forgotten woman behind Hitchcock, who was one of the co-writers of this film that we're talking about today. She is a professor of film studies in the Cinematic Arts Department at the University of Miami, where she teaches courses in film history, gender, and directors. Her publications include the books Feminist Hollywood from Born in Flames to Point Break and Magnolia, as well as articles in Cinema Journal, Feminist Media Histories, the Quarterly Review of Film and Television Cinephiles, and the Journal of Popular Film and TV. So, Christina, I'm so happy to have you. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
As I said, I just finished the book last night, and I just thought it was really wonderful. And, you know, it's one of these hidden, there's so many hidden treasures from classic Hollywood, particularly female contributions. And as someone, you know, who largely, you know, grew up reading behind me Hitchcock, Truffaut, can't help but keep thinking Hitchcock, Hitchcock, Hitchcock did this, Hitchcock did that. But I'm guilty of forgetting that there are so many people who, without someone like Alma Reville, his wife, or Joan Harrison, and many other people, there really would be no Alfred Hitchcock or any filmmaker for that matter. So I really, really loved it. And I just wanted to ask you off the top, before we get into the film, because I know that you said that you didn't grow up with films, that it wasn't until you were in university that you began to study films formally. So I'm curious, what were you initially pursuing when you went into university? Did you have a different plan in mind for what you wanted to do with your life?
Ah, okay. Yeah. You know, I was interested. First, I was an English major. I was a really traditional English major, creative writing when I was in college. And I fell into actually like a film and writing class, which exposed me to documentary. So I thought that I wanted to do film production and documentary filmmaking related to like women's issues and social issues. And quickly actually learned that I wasn't really a film production person, and I wasn't gonna do well on like a set, getting up early in the morning, you know. And I'm glad that I learned that, because people who go against their skills are not, you know, are not happy people. But
yeah,
but
it's a tough life to be on set a lot. Yeah, the hours and everything it's pretty grueling and demanding.
It is, and you have to really want to do that. You know, for people who are good at it, that, you know, kudos to them. But I realized that what I really love to do is write about film, teach film, you know, study it, and do a lot of reading, you know, like reading film criticism. So I followed that path and began watching a lot of classic Hollywood cinema.
What how did you come, because I know that the Hitchcock course that you took at the University of Texas, why was the Hitchcock course something of interest to you? Or was it something that was part of your curriculum? Or was it something that you decided you wanted to learn about?
You know, actually, I'm glad you asked that, because it was something I took when I was beyond all that coursework. I was writing, you know, my dissertation. So it was definitely something I just wanted to do. And I probably felt like, gosh, this is the only chance I'm going to take, you know, have to take an Alfred Hitchcock, a course in directors, and of course, specializing in Hitchcock. And my professor was Thomas Schatz. I always like to give him, give him his, you know, I just really appreciate his work. And I wanted to have the chance to take that class with him before I graduated. And when I did, he pointed me right in the direction of, you know, the female collaborators with Hitchcock. He knew my interests, and he pointed me toward Joan Harrison in particular, because there was an archive, that the Harry Ransom Center there, that had a lot of Selznick papers, and he knew that I could go do some research on Harrison. And so that's where my research started.
It's yeah, and I know that you mentioned him in the acknowledgement. So it's always great when someone puts you on a path that perhaps you didn't expect. What was it? Was it a big surprise that to you that many of his films that, you know, were largely, he had a lot of female writers? I mean, was that something that came as a surprise to you, or did you already know that?
You know, it was a surprise because when we watch so many Hitchcock films, especially, I think that at that time in the 1990s, you know, there had been obviously a lot of feminist analysis of Hitchcock's work. I mean, Tanya Modaleski is somebody who had done a lot of groundbreaking work on his films, but there hadn't been this whole breakout in what we call industry studies, which is looking at the production files and really looking at the context of the making of films. So a lot of the assumptions about Hitchcock's films was that they were indeed like misogynist, right? And that there was this pretty flat approach to gender. Mm-hmm. So that was what really opened up the doors for me, was being able to look at Hitchcock's films. You know that there's so much going on in them, like gender-wise, but once I began to look at the making of them and see, well, there's so many women involved in making them, right? Then you can see, well, of course, there's so much going on with the gender politics.
You know, this book is, I mean, the research is tremendous. And I appreciate that towards the back, you have all the notes and on it. Now, was this different to research as opposed to the other books you wrote? Was there a different approach that you took with this?
Yeah, I did. There was a lot of archival research, you know, primary research in archives. I think in the end, I went to like 14 archives all across the country, and including in England. And of course, what the issue was that Joan Harrison didn't have any personal papers, you know, so I wasn't able to look into her files because there were none, you know.
It's interesting. So she didn't keep anything. That's interesting. Right. Yeah. Any indication as to why that was?
I think so part of it was that anything that she would have held on to in terms of personal correspondence or letters or even like production papers that she might have held on to along the way, those would have been destroyed in this fire that happened in the early 1960s.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Which you wrote about with her, because she wasn't there, but her husband was there. Yeah. That was quite scary and tragic. Jesus.
Yeah, it was devastating. In fact, I was just seeing that this is like, this week is the anniversary of that fire. I think it was 1961. So I think it's a particular, you know, anniversary of that.
Oh, right.
Of that fire. But in Bel Air, that took a whole bunch of homes, including, you know, I think Joan Fontaine's home actually was affected by that.
Oh, wow.
By that fire.
I should look that up.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, you know, it was devastating to the Hollywood community, but it would have wiped away any history of Joan Harrison's up until that point. And that was the most important production, you know, kind of production window of hers, 1940s through the, you know, 50s, the 30s, 40s, and 50s for her. But then in addition to that, I think that she also didn't, while she understood that she was clearly important, you know, she knew that she was a screenwriter and a producer, and she felt that she was doing valuable work. I don't think that she was holding on to stuff in the way that she thought that there would be a library, you know, for her.
I see.
Yeah. So beyond that point in the 60s, I don't think that she was keeping things in that, you know, in that sense.
I see. And who was the most helpful in terms of just meeting people one-on-one? I know Norman Lloyd was a big help. Was there anyone else who significantly helped find information about Joan?
Yeah. So Monica Henreid, who's Paul Henreid's daughter, we know Paul Henreid from Casablanca and now Voyager, and they were, Joan Harrison and he and his wife, they were very good friends beginning from the point at which she came to Los Angeles. So Monica Henreid is her goddaughter, is Joan Harrison's goddaughter.
Oh, right. Yes.
Right. And she was helpful partly in just telling a lot of stories, bringing me close to the psychology of Joan Harrison, because she knew her all the way up until when Joan began to get a little ill in her older age. And then she also could connect me with other people, which I just, you know, as much as you can read about somebody and even read their production files, I just really needed, you know, I needed someone to help fill in like who she was as a person.
Yes, absolutely. Because you certainly seem to capture who she was from my point of view. And I felt that this must have gone beyond reading and archives to get to the heart of who this woman was. And I think she was an extraordinary woman, which leads me to wonder what, out of all the female collaborators he had, his wife and so many other women, why did you choose Joan Harrison to write a book about, as opposed to, you know, maybe you're going to do more, but right, at this right. time anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were so many, I mean, I could probably name 8 or 9, you know, women who worked on his films and who made a huge contribution. And there really does need to be a substantial book on his wife, you know, on Alma Ravel. There's been a little bit, you know, there has been one book by her daughter, but I don't think that that takes the perspective of kind of the scholarly angle on her.
Right.
But I chose to do Joan Harrison partly because she had such a, you know, she worked with Hitchcock from the 1930s through the 40s and the 50s and into the 60s. So such a long career with him. And I felt that she influenced his career from the very beginning when he was taking his own, like his own vision was taking shape, you know, starting in the mid 1930s. So I believe that she brought with her this whole idea about kind of the Gothic suspense film, you know, and even the romantic kind of that thriller, the serial comic thriller that we know, the 39 Steps. I thought that she brought in her own idea about couples and, you know, and kind of that journey that couples take. She was there kind of helping to inform his own ideas at that early stage. And then I also am sure that she influenced his idea of the Hitchcock blonde because, you know, because she was this really stunning woman. And she was, I think just this ideal, you know, this ideal kind of beauty for him. So that helped me understand kind of that relationship that was going on, you know, between, again, I talk about this in terms of Hitchcock and Harrison and Alma, right? And that to me, I wanted to bring into the book as well.
I believe she found the book on suspicion and brought it to Hitchcock. Is that, I believe, yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah.
Yeah, I do think that's right. Yeah. And that, so the book Before the Fact, which was written by Frances Iles, she brought it to him. And so the book was already kind of in development at RKO under other screenwriters. So, you know, he might have found it. He may have found his way into it in some other way if she hadn't brought it to him, but it was perfect for her. It was right in her, you know, right in her wheelhouse. And so as she was looking for material.
I actually thought it was a female writer because it seemed the book just, it seemed to capture what particularly at that time who feel trapped in a marriage that they can't get out of and a divorce at that time not being acceptable socially, and her passiveness and her insecurities and her night. I just thought, wow. I mean, I thought it was surprised it was a man because I just thought it was it seemed like something a woman write. I don't know if that was your feelings when you heard about the book.
Yeah, definitely. And so it's like the author had female readers in mind for sure, right? And could kind of grab that women's psychology, capture women's psychology. So this was right up Joan Harrison's alley. She would have been dying to make this book into a film.
Yeah, no, I'm glad she did. I like I said, I had never seen it before, and I have this TCM box set. I love these the Hitchcock box sets, and I just for some reason had never seen it before. But I watched it the other night, and I was really really fascinated by it, particularly as I said the Joan Fontaine character. So I was curious, how do you feel about this film, and when you first saw it, and has your feelings changed about it after knowing what went into the making of it?
Yeah, so this is one of those films I saw early on, you know, as I was falling in love with this kind of gothic suspense and the psychological thriller way back when I was just coming into these films. And I at first, I really liked this genre because, or this subgenre, you know, because it captured the idea of, a woman vulnerability, right? You know, Joan Fontaine being so vulnerable and so, it's like a journey, I suppose, because at a certain point she decides to stand up for herself. You know, I think it's really late in this film. It's pretty late because I guess because she in this version, at least in the in this iteration, she decides not to drink the poisoned milk, you know, right. So she decides she's not gonna die for her husband. But all of these themes were what was interesting to me when I first came into Suspicion. But I guess knowing the different production issues, now I just find it fascinating because, you know, and I know that we'll talk about this, but just because the whole team was grappling with like, whose story is this ultimately, right? And like what, you know, it's such a power struggle ultimately between the different cast members and the writers, and what is the story about?
Yeah. I read that because apparently Cary Grant didn't, as you wrote in the book, didn't realize that this is really Joan Fontaine, her story from her POV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, him being a big star, I'm sure that hit at his ego. But then apparently he even was arguing with Hitchcock because he felt that Hitchcock favored her over him. And there was some arguments on set. I mean, maybe that added to the to the angst, because this is a part I mean, he's played, you know, the charmer and stuff, but he is not, I mean, he may not be the killer as is in the book there strongly suggesting, and to this film to an extent as well, even though they, you know, wrap it up in a way where he's not, but it's still, which I know we'll probably get into, it's more on the ambiguous side. But I mean, he is such a charmer, such a hustler, such a gambler, con man, user. I mean, I kept thinking, just leave this guy. But then at the same time, I could understand her where she was coming from. She was extremely insecure. She was very naive. I thought as soon as she was so happy when he showed up, even though he ignored her for a week or so, when he said he was going to meet her at that party, and then in the car immediately said, "I love you." And you see his face, he's a little like, he looks a little like, why are you saying that to me so soon? But you understand that he marries her because he wanted her money. She was from a rich family, and this was he's such an opportunist. Again, I know in the end they blur the lines there because you never quite know whether that is necessarily true or not. But I'm curious, what was your impression of the Joan Fontaine character? I mean, how did you see her?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, first of all, she was dying to make the film, right? You know, part of the backstory is that she really wanted to be cast in Suspicion. And so she, I guess, sent a personal note to Hitchcock. And she was under contract with Selznick, so there had to be a special arrangement with RKO for her to be brought over to make the film. So clearly she saw that this was a character, mm-hmm. that would be a good follow-up to her character in Rebecca, and that this was something she could really sink her teeth into. And I think that partly she really does, like, she, you know, this is her film. I mean, Cary Grant does an amazing job. But I think she's right, like, in terms of just kind of inhabiting this character who really is, at the same time as she's carrying so many of these scenes, you know, and her kind of conflict is so dramatic that we're taken up in, you know, there are a lot of close-ups, right? And then
yes.
Hitchcock does this great job of placing us in her subjectivity and her point of view, at the same time as what's happening to her is that she's losing it, right? She's losing herself, and, you know, she's really basically, I think it's Bill Crone that says, you know, by the end, this is like a suicide note that, you know, right, she's writing her own suicide note in the book. And so as we watch her in the end, she's willing to just basically plant her own demise at the end of the film. So we're watching her just kind of suffer out.
Yes. Right? Yeah. No, and, you know, it's an incredible performance. And I don't know her work very well, other than this and now Rebecca, of course, I've seen in this. I can't really even, and I know she was a big star, but, and I'm a huge classic Hollywood fan, but I have to see more of her films, because I thought that she was so good in this. And I agree with you. I mean, this was from her point of view. This was really her story. And, you know, where we often see in films where the females are reacting off the male stories, in this case, it's very much he's reacting off of her story. And I thought I mean, not that it's all necessarily all about her. Obviously, he's a big part of it. But I just thought the vulnerabilities and the confusion and the not knowing what to do, which so often in life is perhaps how people feel more than we see often in conventional filmmaking, where characters know what they're doing and they're even in obstacles that are so challenging are still able to overcome it and jump into it. And this, I really appreciated it because it shows that it's never that simple. And I love that, even that moment towards the end when she realizes that she believes he's going to poison her, and then she just faints, just like no one to call, no one to tell. And, you know, her father had died, and how was she going to, again, you're worrying about what people are going to think. And she's from this society where she likely would have been ridiculed or criticized, and that's what I took from it anyways. But I just thought, wow, I mean, she just played it so beautifully. Were there some Hitchcock touches here that really popped out to you? And from my point of view, it was less of his obvious touches. I mean, cinematically speaking, was there something that you felt as a recurring shot or motif or theme in this film?
Right. Yeah. So I think that there are those moments, you know, where that expressionistic, the camera work that is very, you know, very wrapped up in the shadows and the expressionism does come out. Yeah. So it's not, might not be as often, but especially when inside the house, right, inside her house, when she begins to suspect that maybe Johnny is killing Beaky, or the Beaky yes. character is under duress. And so in the living room, you see some of that happen where from her perspective, everything is kind of off kilter. Or again, the infamous scene when, you know, when Johnny is bringing the milk up the stairs, and we have that kind of,
right,
this kind of spider web like image. So, but those are iconic, right?
Yes. I mean,
yeah. So they really stand out. They stand out not just in the film, but like in film history.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That shot is so, you know, I don't even think you don't even need to have known this film to know the scene where he has the milk going up the stairs. I particularly noticed that on the staircase, no matter where they were in the house, you saw the shadows from the window bars on the wall. And for me, it just gave the feeling of being trapped, just these shadows of bars everywhere. Yeah. I really, and again, his use of POV, which uses so much, particularly that scene at the end, when you think he's going to kill her in the car, and every time she looks to the right, it's her POV of Cary Grant, which, you know, he did in The Wrong Man when Henry Fonda is being arrested. And so often that feeling of being trapped and claustrophobic and helpless in that moment. And even later, there was an earlier one, as soon as she finds out that was it Blinky? Binky, the friend?
I think it's Beaky.
Beaky. When she finds out he dies, and suddenly you see Cary Grant in the doorway, and it's slightly askew, the shot, but it's from her POV, which reminded me of he did a very similar shot in Notorious, where Ingrid Bergman is in bed and looking at Cary Grant again coming in. Did you think that Cary Grant's character loved her at all? What did you think? It's hard to say, right?
It is hard to say. And that, you know, I think that because I was rereading the various rewrites of the, you know, there are like a few final scenes that are just rewritten over and over and over again. Mainly,
yeah, you mentioned that in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And I think they're mainly written by Joan Harrison and Alma Ravel. And I don't really think they even know, right? Like in the book, it's obvious that the husband that Johnny does not love,
right,
Lena, you know, I mean, he is a murderer, and he is killing her, and she does die. So
right,
it's unambiguous. And so then they're left with this in the film where they know they have to do something different because of the production code, and also just because of audience expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so there are all these scenes that are trying to basically work this out, where Lena is like, well, talk to me about when you were a little boy. And what was that little boy like? You know, so she's trying to basically allow Johnny to redeem himself or explain his motivations.
Right.
And And all of it seems very confusing in terms of whether he was ever, even as a young boy, was he ever like, quote unquote, good, you know, and nobody could, even the writers really have no sense.
Well, you know, I think it makes it much more of a rich experience because you think that he's after her money. Then when that doesn't work out because her father didn't leave them any money, and I couldn't help but laugh when they're reading out the will and Cary Grant is just expecting to get this inheritance, and you see when all he finds out about is the painting, and he's using a look on his face, and he goes over to the painting and says, "You won." I just thought, you know, Hitchcock, I shouldn't say Hitchcock, I should say the writers, Joan Harrison and Alma Reville and Rafelson really brought in that tongue-in-cheek humor to even the most serious and dramatic of situations that he always had in a number of the films that he directed. But, you know, when that didn't work out, he goes on that other scheme, of course, with his friend, and everything is pointing to that he's going to now kill his friend. And when that doesn't work out, you know, he's going to try to kill his wife to get the insurance money. And then even in the end, even though he says that he was going to kill himself and not her, is that another lie? I mean, is there any reason to believe him, right? I mean, so they probably were able to satisfy the censors, but at the same time, you know, the audience maybe will think it's a happy ending. They do that U-turn and go back home. But is it? So I would have much preferred the ending in the, not that I've read the book, but that sounds like a really fascinating way to end it. Or the other idea that I believe was Hitchcock's to, you know, that she writes she writes a note to her mother that he's going to kill her and basically a goodbye. And then he mails it. So therefore he killed her, but he'll get caught. It's too bad they couldn't get that through.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that would have been a great ending because then everybody, right? I mean, she dies, which happens in the novel. So you have that kind of faith, you know, the fidelity to the novel, and then Cary Grant gets punished. So everything kind of happens the way it really should happen. And the audience, I think, would have a sense of satisfaction. But that, I guess that just wasn't meant to be, you know.
Yeah. Not at that time, unfortunately.
Yeah, it just would have been, I think it wasn't deemed appropriate, right, by RKO. But you know, the other thing that is happening with the persona of Cary Grant is that, you know, his charm and his just, you know, you have the fact that he's just such a handsome, romantic, wonderful, suave guy. And so even if he really does have the worst of intentions, he's working on the audience in that way. And you also understand, right, why Lena stays in the game, I guess, you know, and wants to think the best of him. Mm-hmm. So,
I think she couldn't help but partly be, again, you know, nothing is simple, right? I mean, it's complicated because I think she couldn't help but, even as ambiguous as he is, you wonder whether she really loves him, because she also felt that no one would, her family's worried that no one's going to marry her, and she's, you know, and then she starts to think, well, maybe I should marry him because he was flirting with her and coming on to her. But it makes me wonder, did she really love him, or maybe she was just very charmed by him? I mean, you know, because I've known people like that who are all up to no good, but they could just charm the pants off of you. And I think we all have met someone like that in our life. But again, it just makes for such an enriching experience to see it again and again. Did you read the book? I'm curious if you read the book.
I did read the book. Yeah.
How is the book? Because it seems like it's really well read, really well written.
Yeah, it is really good. It's very good. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about it is that Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca does something similar, right? So when you put these two books beside each other, you know, right, they're similar in the sense that both protagonists feel that they're under that they're kind of under siege by their husband.
That's right.
Yeah. Although the main difference is that du Maurier really uses that I, right? She literally puts you in the perspective of the protagonist, and she uses the first person. Mm-hmm. So so that you, in that way, you must live past the end, because she's literally telling it from her perspective. And so if she's using that first person I, then you you're not going to get right. You're not going to die, but because right. it's the third person with the right.
I guess, see.
I think that's the difference in a way is that because the Francis Iles or Anthony Berkeley Cox, who's the real name, you know, of the writer of Before the Fact.
Yeah. Cause he had what do you call that?
Like a pen name.
Pen name. Right. Yeah.
So he, just because of the way that he presents the perspective, he's actually able to tell you that this, you know, that our main character, I should say, dies, right? She's a goner. Mm-hmm. And so it's just an interesting twist on what's very much the same story. It's really a similar story.
I got to read the book because it sounds quite interesting. And I believe there's a scene when the father dies, I believe like the Cary Grant character literally was in that moment, was screaming at him or something for the inheritance. And I thought, wow, so it seems like it's much darker because you never even see him with the father in this movie, right? I mean, they just, you know that the father doesn't want her to marry, to get married. And I like that he just had her leave the house and you wonder, why does she look upset? She's about to hug her mother and then boom, they're eloping and you know, oh, okay, she went again. I like how he handled that without having a lot of dialogue or a lot of, he did it his use of visually, which was quite extraordinary. Is there something about Joan Harrison that you particularly want people to take after they read your book? Is there something that you feel is the most important?
I would want people to just basically have a better sense of how important she was, not only to Hitchcock, but, you know, in her own right, because of these films that she produced even after the films that we're talking about, you know, so after Suspicion and Rebecca and Foreign Correspondent, for example, she then goes on and she has this career as a producer. Mm-hmm. She makes Phantom Lady and Ride the Pink Horse and They Won't Believe Me. And these are all films that, I mean, if you're a noir fan and you've seen like almost everything, you've probably seen, right? Yeah. You've probably seen these, but you may not have even realize that they're produced, you know, right. by Joan Harrison. And also that she had so much input on the writing and like every aspect of them. So I just would really, you know, emphasize that part of her influence on noir as a genre, you know, and on 40s Hollywood. So the more that I learn, it is one of those things where you're tugging at a string, and the more that you start pulling, you're like, she couldn't have been over here and over here, right? And right. over there. And so hopefully people will begin to see just how she was everywhere.
She really was. I love film noir, and I know this is Noirvember, and I really have to watch Phantom Lady because I actually have never seen that. But I had a guest on recently who brought it up and said and he's a big noir guy and he thought it was one of the best film noirs. So you can certainly see that she was someone who was more interested in character, particularly from even this film, Suspicion, mm-hmm. because I often lead, like I said, I lead Hitchcock's film less on the character and more on everything around that. And this is one, not always, but this is one that particularly is a great focus on character. And I was also curious if this might be kind of a bit of a funny question, but when you're doing this much research on this, on Joan and talking to people she knew and people she worked with, did she ever come to you in her dreams at all?
That is funny, actually. You know, I there was no dream, like, but I did feel like she was just always, you know, present. It did feel that she was hanging with me and giving me like a kick in the butt all the time when I wasn't, you know, getting progress done. Because she also was, and you know, I know that some people may not, you know, believe in like the metaphysical whatever, but I did feel that she was quite present during the like 6 years that I was writing the book. And then the last 2 years, you know, she was apparently someone who was just really quite self-determined, right? I mean, she was not always, you know, she could be a bit harsh, right? She could, you know, she would get the job done. She would be a bit of a hard ass. And so I felt that she was doing that to me. She's like the producer on set.
You know? Yeah, like, get on it, man.
So I definitely, you know, I really did enjoy getting to know her. I know that some biographers, right, feel that they need to create distance and that they are much more kind of detached from their subject for a reason, but I personally couldn't do that, right? Like I had to feel like I was really entering like the world of Joan Harrison, you know, and seeing things from her perspective. Maybe that's maybe because this was my first biography. So I had to kind of get to know the form, but I did, by the time I was done, I felt like I had gotten to know some version, you know, some version of Joan Harrison. And it was a pleasure. Like it was just a real pleasure to do that.
Yeah, no, you certainly felt that. And isn't there a story you told recently that you went to a psychic for something that you wanted and then it showed up? Would you mind telling that one again?
Yeah, no, I don't mind telling that one again. Yeah, I sometimes refrain from telling that one because I don't know how people feel about psychics, but I love it.
I love that story.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. Basically, I was toward the end of the whole writing of the book, and I was a little bit vexed because, you know, there is this question for, and it comes up in Suspicion too, right? There's this lesbian subtext in Suspicion.
Right. That's the dinner scene, right? At the, where they're all openly talking about the murder and.
Yeah. And there's this, so Joan Harrison wrote this extra character in, which is the, basically you can kind of tell that there's this partner, this female partner for the detective writer, the mystery writer, Isabel. So around that dinner table, you see Phyllis, and within the screenplay, it's made very clear, you know, it like, so written into the script, it's made very clear that Phyllis is the partner of Isabel.
Right.
And so it's clear to me that Joan Harrison throughout many of her films was writing in lesbian characters and lesbian subtext. And then as I was meeting people, you know, who had basically known her later in life, those people were telling me that they had been told, right? So it's kind of secondhand, but it kept getting confirmed around and around that that like the love of her life had been a woman.
Right.
You know? And so at a certain point I went through stages, but I did feel like for the book that I would like to know who this love of her life was, right? Who was this woman that was the love of her life? Partly not because it was that important, you know what I mean? I mean, some people will say, well, who really cares? But partly because I thought, well, what if somebody comes up, you know, behind me and writes a book and they have this information and then I kind of look like a fool because I didn't, you know, it was out there and I didn't find it. So I did. So there is the psychic that I find to be very credible. Like she has come up with true things in the past. And I happened to be talking to her about something else. And I said, well, can you maybe help me with this question about like, who was Joan Harrison's lesbian love? And she came up with this thing where she said, you know, well, this is all going to be revealed. I see a box opening and like, I see a dove flying out from this box and it's a box of letters and trust me, you know, this is all going to come to you. And within 2 weeks, I was speaking to someone else who was the personal assistant of Joan, right? And Joan and Eric Ambler. So Eric Ambler was Joan's husband for many years.
Right.
And he was a really well-known spy novelist. So, but the question always was, if Eric and Joan were married for so many years, then how did this other woman fit in to the picture? And so sure enough, I'm speaking to this this source, this personal assistant. And at the end of the conversation, she says, you know, well, I have this huge box of letters. Would you like them? And she was willing to mail them to me. And then I received, you know, but basically it was a box of love letters between Joan and Eric.
That's right. Yeah. Cause you wrote them in the book, particularly cause they were separated, not cause they were separated, the relationship, but just cause of her working and having to travel and how much they missed each other. But that part of the book is quite sweet. Cause I know that she got married in her early 50s, but she seemed to find the right person, even though she avoided marriage at all costs before then. Yes. Again, the book is Phantom Lady, Hollywood producer, Joan Harrison, the forgotten woman behind Hitchcock. And again, I love the cover art and who did this, the cover art here?
It is beautiful. That was Lindsay Cleworth, and she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, it's great. Because is this a photo that you found and brought to her, or was this that someone else brought?
Yeah, so that's a photo from Vogue magazine in the 40s. And then, okay. I brought that to her, and then she did the art.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love the way that Joan dressed as well. I love the I love the her cheat style is so great. And where is the best place for people to buy a copy of it?
Chicago Review Press is a great place to go, and also bookshop.org.
Okay.
So that you can promote local bookshops in your area.
Okay.
So bookshop.org or Chicago Review Press would be great.
Great, perfect. Well, Christina, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate that you took the time to talk about the book and Suspicion. So thanks. I hope you can come again.
Thanks, Robert. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
No, thank you. And just lastly, to the audience, this is the first time here for anyone. I also have a Patreon membership, and I have a tier which is dedicated to the films directed by Hitchcock. Just go to patreon.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies. If you want to become a member, you can sign up there. And if this is your first time on my YouTube channel, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the movies logo. You'll see it just floating above my head here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live on YouTube. And thanks so much, everyone. We'll see you in the next time.